who they referred to simply as the occupant of the White House, for its attacks on Omar, and to send a message to both political parties, hands off Ilhan Omar. She says she has suffered a spike in death threats against her since President Trump pinned a tweet of a video that juxtaposed Ilhan Omar against the 9/11 attacks. This does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a paid full-time digital fellowship here in New York City. We also are accepting applications for paid six-month internships. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Kay Marie Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DiFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
May is Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Month. So to recognize our Asian and Pacific Islander American identified community, Cable will be airing all Asian and Pacific Islander programming from 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. on Friday, May 3rd. That day, we'll be airing features from your favorite API KBOO programmers. Tune in to hear episodes of Lip Fantastic, APA Compass, DMA Roberts' award-winning series, Crossing East, and an all-new Pacific Underground and music playlist by Sun Lee and DJ Diablo. That's Asian and Pacific Islander American Heritage Day, Friday, May 3rd, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. For more information and program schedule, just go to our website at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Zenith Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Thursday, May 2nd at 6:30 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland. This is the fourth community forum about Zenith Energy's ongoing expansion of their Portland Tar Sands Oil Facility. The panel will discuss how this facility's operations can harm people, urban wildlife, rivers, and air quality, as well as background on the terminal site, climate justice impacts, ideas for public action, and more. Again, that's the Zenith Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Thursday, May 2nd from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church, 2710 Northeast 14th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Hopsworks Urban Brewery, offering sustainable brews and local food for 10 years, serving the community at three locations: Hopsworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, Bike Bar at North Williams Avenue, and in Vancouver on Southeast Mill Plain Boulevard. More information online at hopsworksbeer.com. It's a couple minutes past five, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon-based cannabis company has been sold for over $1 billion.
The Oregon House is scheduled to vote on increased school funding.
And in national news, Attorney General William Barr testified in front of Congress today.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 1st, 2019. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. The program manager for Multnomah County's Diane Wade House, Onisha Cochran, was fired Monday, just 3 weeks after officials and her employer hailed her unique abilities to lead the program. Cochran is an ex-convict who was asked to run a new transitional home for African-American women coming out of prison or who are on probation. Cochran says she refused to sign her termination letter, which cited an ongoing, quote, pattern of failure to demonstrate effective leadership and professionalism, end quote. The letter also said she had an inability to respond to community partner concerns, a lack of accountability, and an overall need to improve performance. Cochran says she believes her employer, the nonprofit group Bridges to Change, retaliated against her for her outspokenness in pushing for Afrocentric mentorship and support programs for residents. Cochran said, quote, "I put my heart and soul into this program. I believe they wanted a step and fetch it black person who would say, yes, sir, no, sir, whatever you say, whatever you need me to do. And that's not who I am." The executive director of Bridges to Change, Monta Knudsen, said he could not discuss a personnel matter. Cochran had worked for Bridges to Change since May of last year. She was promoted in December from a supervisor to program manager. Cochran and her supporters plan to speak out against her firing at the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners meeting on May 9th.
The Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, or IRCO, is not going to stay neutral towards employee union efforts. IRCO is a nonprofit that assists refugees in multiple aspects, including English language classes, after-school programs, job placement, as well as providing financial help with food, rent, and utilities. IRCO employs over 200 full-time and part-time staff, plus hundreds more other employees, such as interpreters. Last year, a small group of workers started talking with Oregon AFSCME. After months of meetings with employees interested in unionizing, Oregon AFSCME approached IRCO management with a request that the group stay neutral towards employee union efforts. However, IRCO Executive Director Lee Po Cha declined and instead hired management side labor law firm Buller Law. One previous IRCO employee, Sahar Yarjani Marinovic, who is now a union-backed candidate running unopposed for David Douglas School Board, cited various reasons to management explaining her decision to quit. Specifically among these reasons, immigrants and people of color make up most of the staff, but earn less than native-born white staff for the same work and have a slower track to promotion. Marinovic's exit spurred others to speak out. Dozens of employees signed a petition to management in December, accusing supervisors broadly of abusive practices and microaggressions, and describes IRCO as a racially hostile environment. The petition called for an outside audit on diversity, equality, and inclusion, and asked management to be transparent about how IRCO is complying with the new state law requiring equal pay for comparable work.
Bills to address climate change and its effects are still on the table halfway through the Oregon legislative session. KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has more on the story.
A little more than halfway through the session, advocates for action on climate change see a lot of potential in the Oregon legislature. Environmental and clean energy groups got their first major victory in March when lawmakers passed a bill banning offshore oil drilling, and a bill banning fracking is still on the table. But Zach Baker, Oregon policy manager with the organization Climate Solutions, says the most ambitious legislation, the Clean Energy Jobs Bill, could determine this session's legacy on climate action. House Bill 2020 would require large polluters to buy credits for greenhouse gas emissions and place a cap on emissions that would decrease over time.
Passing the Clean Energy Jobs Bill would be the most ambitious climate program in Oregon's history. And the legislature has been working on this for a number of years and is poised this year to pass the bill.
Baker says an amendment to the bill would ensure funds from the greenhouse gas credits would be invested in communities most affected by climate change, including communities of color, tribes, rural communities, and to help low-income families. Critics of the bill say it could hit consumers hard, increasing energy prices, particularly for gasoline. Lawmakers are considering another innovative bill. Baker says Governor Kate Brown included in her budget a proposal to create a new state agency called the Oregon Climate Authority that would focus on addressing climate change and the transition to clean energy.
It would be the first state agency in the country to focus exclusively on climate change. And we think it could elevate the importance of climate and state government and provide better coordination among state agencies to address the climate crisis.
Legislators are also looking at a bill that would aid the transition to electric vehicles and expand renewable energy, such as rooftop solar. The session is scheduled to adjourn at the end of June. This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
On Monday, the Oregon Senate moved forward with a plan to limit the state's supply of recreational legal marijuana. Lawmakers voted 18-10 to freeze marijuana productions at current levels for the next 2 years. The state will not issue new production licenses to marijuana growers, but current growers will be able to renew their licenses. Democrat Senator Michael Denbro from Portland said the state produces so much marijuana that Oregon has enough of the drug to last it for the next 6.5 years. That surplus has caused prices to plummet. Lawmakers rejected different versions of the bill. At that time, Republicans claimed that the marijuana industry should be regulated by the free market, not the state. This time around, some Republicans pointed out that the latest bill was narrower in scope and changed their vote. The measure now goes to the House for consideration.
In other cannabis-related news, it was announced today that Portland-based Cura Cannabis has been sold for more than $1 billion. It's the largest deal ever among North American companies operating in the legalized marijuana business and underscores the enormous potential investors see in the market for legalized marijuana. Cura sells its cannabis oils on the wholesale and retail market under the Select brand and operates in California, Arizona, and Nevada. The company has 500 employees and had revenue of $117 million last year, triple its revenue from 2017. Cura was purchased by Curaleaf Holdings, a Massachusetts company whose shares trades on the Canadian market. The deal combines Curaleaf's focus on the eastern United States with Cura's markets in the west. The size of the transaction underscores the enormous potential investors see in the market for legalized marijuana and the rapidly evolving commercial landscape within the cannabis sector. With the surge in popularity of vaping, Cura became the supplier for many of the best-known cannabis brands. Cura sells vaping oils under its own Select name for vaping, as well as Select brand cannabid oil, CBD, which doesn't include THC.
Scooters returned to Portland over the weekend for a second one-year trial period. In response to residents, a stricter set of guidelines has been imposed this time. Changes include geofencing to prevent scooters from entering Waterfront Park, as well as fines for riding on the sidewalk in illegal parking. In addition, small squares will be marked on sidewalks and streets as scooter parking places to prevent them from blocking pedestrians or the right-of-way. Companies that help eliminate sidewalk riding, improper parking, and those that help generate high ridership in East Portland will be allowed to expand their fleets. The first pilot showed that scooter riders prefer riding on bike lanes when they are available rather than sidewalks. The Portland Bureau of Transportation will charge a 5 to 20 cent right-of-way fee to the companies, with the money being used to develop more protected bike lanes and neighborhood greenways. The Portland Bureau of Transportation has issued permits to Bolt, Lime and Spin, and four other companies that are in line for the licenses once they submit proof that they can satisfy the city's requirements. More information on scooter usage can be found at portlandoregon.gov/transportation.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news from the BOO at 5:30, followed by Sojourner Truth at 6. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy, morning giving away to afternoon sun with temperatures in the upper 60s. East of the Cascades and Hood River, you can expect similar conditions. Today in history, in 1950, Gwendolyn Brooks became the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize for her book of poetry, Annie Allen. In 1976, she became the first African-American woman inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. The quote of the day is from Gwendolyn Brooks, who said, quote, "Look at what's happening in this world. Every day there's something exciting or disturbing to write about. With all that's going on, how could I stop?"
Don Donald Trump routinely claims he is the greatest president ever, but there is one attribute which clearly sets him apart from his 44 predecessors: his ability to lie. According to the Washington Post fact checker, Trump has made over 10,000 false or misleading statements during his presidency. According to the Post, it took the president 600 days to reach the 5,000 lie level, an average of 8 lies per day, with many of them falling during unhinged Twitter rants, Fox News interviews, and campaign rallies. It took him an additional 226 days to break the 10,000 lie threshold, a truly staggering run rate at 23 false statements per day. In fact, in the 3-day period last month, the Post documented 171 false or misleading claims.
A judge in the United Kingdom has sentenced WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to 50 weeks in prison for skipping bail 7 years ago. Judge Deborah Taylor said Assange's 7-year stint in the Ecuadorian embassy had cost U.S. taxpayers £16 million, or $21 million. She also said he sought asylum at the embassy as a, quote, deliberate attempt to delay justice. Assange sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in June 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he was wanted for questioning over rape and sexual assault allegations. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, told the court that his client sought refuge in the embassy because, quote, he was living with overwhelming fear of being rendered to the U.S., end quote. Specifically, Assange feared that he could possibly be sent to Guantanamo Bay. Assange was arrested on April 11th after Ecuador revoked his political asylum. Speaking to reporters outside the court after Assange's arrest, WikiLeaks editor Kristen Harafson argued the case sets a dangerous precedent, saying, quote, anyone who wants the press to be free should consider the implications of this case. If they will extradite a journalist to the U.S., then no journalist will be safe, end quote. Assange faces a separate court hearing on Thursday for a U.S. extradition request. U.S. authorities have charged Assange with one count of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion after he conspired to break into a Pentagon computer system.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr testified in front of the Senate today. KABU's Ray Bobwell has this report.
For nearly 6 hours today, Attorney General William Barr attempted to defend his handling of the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report during his testimony in front of a frequently hostile group of senators. California Senator Kamala Harris grilled Barr about his review of the evidence in Mueller's report.
In your March 24th summary, you wrote that, quote, after reviewing the special counsel's final report, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein and I have concluded that the evidence is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. My question is, in reaching your conclusion, did you personally review all of the underlying evidence?
No.
As the Attorney General of the United States, you run the United States Department of Justice. If in any U.S. attorney's office around the country, the head of that office, when being asked to make a critical decision about, in this case, the person who holds the highest office in the land, and whether or not that person committed a crime, would you accept them recommending a charging decision to you if they had not reviewed the evidence?
Well, that's a question for Bob Mueller. He's the U.S. attorney. He's the one who presents the report.
But it was you who made the charging decision, sir.
In response to a question from Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut regarding Trump's propensity for lying to the American people, Barr responded, quote, I'm not in the business of determining when lies are told to the American people, end quote. And during her questioning, Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono linked Barr to other Trump associates before calling for his resignation.
Mr. Barr, now the American people know that you are no different from Rudy Giuliani or Kellyanne Conway or any of the other people who sacrificed their once decent reputation for the grifter and liar who sits in the Oval Office. You lied to Congress. Being Attorney General of the United States is a sacred trust. You have betrayed that trust. America deserves better. You should resign.
Barr repeatedly defended his handling of the Mueller report, but the hearing left many wondering how Barr's testimony would align with Robert Mueller when he testifies in front of the House Judiciary Committee in the near future. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
South African Olympic athlete Caster Semenya has lost her appeal against rules designed to regulate testosterone levels in female runners. Semenya is a two-time Olympic champion in the 800 meters. Last year, the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF, introduced new regulations for female athletes with difference of sexual development. Athletes with testosterone levels of 5 nanomoles per liter of blood or above and who are androgen sensitive have to meet certain criteria if they want to compete. They will not be allowed to participate in restricted events on the international level unless they reduce their blood testosterone level below the threshold for a continuous period of at least 6 months. The Court of Arbitration for Sports panels of 3 judges gave a convoluted verdict and dismissed both requests for arbitration from Semenya and the governing body of track and field. In a landmark judgment, the court said the IAAF's proposed rules are discriminatory, but, quote, such discrimination is a necessary, reasonable, and proportionate means of achieving the IAAF's aim of preserving the integrity of female athletics in the restricted events. The IAAF believes female runners with high testosterone levels have an unfair advantage in events. Athletes will now be forced to medicate to suppress their testosterone levels in order to compete. The rules come into force on May 8th.
It's May Day, the perfect day to hear from Rick Smith with Labor Radio in 2.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day May Day celebrators in Cleveland, Ohio, were attacked as they marched to protest the imprisonment of socialist Eugene V. Debs. 1919 was a year of massive upheaval, marked by countless strikes and protests, riots and bomb threats. But much of the country was still caught up in the jingoism of the war. Debs had just entered prison to serve a 10-year sentence. He had been convicted in Cleveland of sedition for an anti-war speech he gave in Canton, Ohio the year before. Thousands of trade unionists, anarchists, socialists, and communists marched toward Public Square in downtown Cleveland. Prominent socialist Charles Rutenberg led one of the contingents. He planned to address the rally in defense of Debs and also to promote his candidacy in the upcoming mayoral elections. May Day marchers carried red flags and American flags and banners reading, "Workers of the World Unite." Liberty Loan workers stopped them en route, demanding they lower their flags. Marchers refused and attempted to proceed towards downtown. Fighting broke out in the streets and lasted for hours until mounted police and army tanks charged the crowd. 2 were killed, at least 40 seriously injured, and as many as 120 were arrested. Rutenberg was charged with assault with intent to kill, though charges were later dismissed. Socialist Party headquarters were ransacked. The city immediately moved to restrict parades and socialist meetings and banned red flags. Local newspapers were quick to scapegoat immigrants and their supported Bolshevik sympathies for the riot. The attack in Cleveland served as an early warning of the Red Scare that would fully erupt by the end of the year. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Now from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, energy efficiency could help the world meet the Paris Climate Agreement goals.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the recipe for slowing global warming, energy efficiency is a critical ingredient. According to the International Energy Agency, improving efficiency could provide more than 40% of the reductions in carbon pollution pledged in the Paris Climate Agreement. That's if individuals, businesses, and governments around the world make full use of the efficiency technologies that already exist. Jason Hartke is president of the Alliance to Save Energy, a nonprofit urging lawmakers to prioritize energy efficiency.
It's a massive part of the solution, something that we need to be doubling down on. The investment in energy efficiency, I would argue, is much lower than it needs to be in the face of the challenge. We've got a lot more to do to have our policy represent the solutions that are going to get us to the Paris Agreement.
Committing to energy efficiency can also benefit the economy because it saves people money that they can then spend elsewhere. For example, U.S. consumers save tens of billions of dollars each year on electricity bills as a result of efficiency standards for household appliances. So Harkey says energy efficiency can help slow global warming and stimulate the economy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
As of midnight tonight, Wednesday local time, Japan has a new emperor. Naruhito will take over as head of the world's oldest monarchy following his father Akihito's historic abdication. Japan is the oldest continuing hereditary monarchy in the world. The new imperial era of Dewa, meaning beautiful harmony, will go on as long as the 59-year-old sits in the chrysanthemum throne. Naruhito will formally take possession of this sacred imperial regalia and imperial seals as proof of his succession as the nation's 126th emperor. While Japanese emperors hold no official political power, they serve as important national figureheads. Naruhito's father, the popular 85-year-old Akihito, assumed the throne in 1989. His time at the head of the monarchy was the first era in Japan's modern history not to be marked by war. Akihito's abdication is the first time in more than 200 years that an emperor has stepped down. He used his final royal speech to offer his gratitude to the people of Japan and to pray for global peace. And now we're going to go to a live segment. We have KABU reporter Tammy Hobteus at the May Day rally. Tammy, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Glad to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing and hearing?
Well, I am here, and it's fantastic on the north side of town. There are about maybe 200 people, many different vendors. You have the Portland Writers Association. You have some representatives from the IWW, some of the great folks from Burgerville, as well as, what is this, the International Women's Day Licenses for All. It's really great. One of the most interesting vendors that I found here was the All African People's Revolution Party, and they are an international party, and they started in Portland not too long ago, and they are some fantastic people that are really giving an example and showing solidarity to what it means to be there and to be present. And we have a lot of women organizations, a lot of just very interesting people that are just showing solidarity with everyone, speakers. Of course, there's also some ASL people signing, and it's great. It's really great energy, a lot of informative pamphlets everywhere. There are books everywhere. It's a great celebration, but also a lot of awareness that there's a reason why we're all here, and showing solidarity to one another is a great way of at least softening the blow that capitalism makes us face every day.
We'll talk a little bit more about your conversations you've had with other people who are at the event and what social issues seem to be at the forefront for them this May Day.
So definitely there is a big push towards organization and organizing and explaining to people what organizing means, whether it is at a workplace. So you have some folks, like I said, from the IWW, and they're just kind of getting people interested and explaining to them what it means to organize, as well as just books. People here are really just glad, they're really glad to be here, but they're mostly interested in sharing the information about how they can make their community better. And there's a lot of really emphasis on community as well as tenant rights. There's plenty of people here from tenant rights for Portland. And most of the conversation, one interesting fact is that there's a lot of conversation around Venezuela and how the USA needs to stay out of the current coup that's happening there.
Well, we're just about out of time. So is there anything else you want to say really briefly about just police presence? How's the vibe?
So they are around. They definitely aren't making themselves shown, but they are around in the perimeters. There are people all around in the park. There are even dogs. And it's just really good vibes here that you can tell everyone here is just trying to make a difference, and they're starting it with their community. And it's a really beautiful place to be right now.
Well, that's great to hear. We've been talking with KABU reporter Tammy Hobteus at the May Day rally. Thanks, Tammy.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 1st, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu and Tammy Habteus. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is David Casters. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. At 9, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Fight the Empire dives further into the Mueller report and looks at the current crisis in Venezuela. At 10, it's The Heather McCoy Show. Heather welcomes the Washington editor of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, to talk about the recent Politico profile of The Intercept and his forthcoming book on Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with Meg Vogt, author of the new book of photographs and poems, MYKU, My Portland. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk with Patricia Welch, OB Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use